Twins, their eyes wide in the darkness. The dead silence that followed was even more terrifying than the knock.
"Open this door at once," Miss Fawthorne demanded, "or I shall have Mr. Tug come up and take the hinges off."
I padded across the room, gave the key a twist, and pulled the door open.
"What is it?" I asked, blinking and rubbing at my eyes. "Is there a fire? I was asleep."
"It's no use, girl," Miss Fawthorne said. "The lights were on in this room. Someone was talking in here."
"I was having a nightmare," I told her. "I expect it's being away from home and so forth. I quite often talk in my sleep."
"Do you indeed?" Miss Fawthorne said. "And do you also switch on electric lights in your sleep?"
"No," I said, "but I didn't know where I was when I woke up. I was disorientated."
It's a bold girl who tries out a new word when she's being grilled,
but I was desperate.
Disorientated was an excuse Daffy had once used when Father had caught her pinching Christmas pudding from the pantry.
"I was disorientated," she had claimed, and Father had believed her, actually believed her.
I shot a quick glance behind me as I switched on the electric light, and the room was bathed in a harsh glare.
"No lights," Miss Fawthorne said, reaching past my face and switching them off again instantly. "Lights out means lights out, you stupid girl."
That did it. As with Ryerson Rainsmith's calling me a drowned rat, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. A week away from home, and my list of people to poison was already up to two.
Three if you counted the insipid Dodo.
From somewhere about her person, Miss Fawthorne produced a packet of paper matches. She struck one gravely, and without taking her eyes from mine, lit the candle. It was rather a neat trick of eye-hand coordination.
"Now then," she said, her gaze fixing me like a butterfly pinned to a card in a specimen box. "To whom were you talking?"
I could see that we were going to sit here until the sun came up, or until I answered. It was obvious that Miss Fawthorne was that kind of person.
"Myself," I admitted, looking away. "I'm afraid I sometimes talk to myself when I'm upset. It's one of my greatest faults. I'm trying to train myself not to do it."
I was wasting my breath, and I knew it even before the words were out of my mouth. Miss Fawthorne was now looking round the room slowly, her head rotating like an owl's. I wondered idly if after a certain number of degrees it would snap and fall off. I rather uncharitably hoped that it did. I didn't dare glance at the fireplace. Doing so would surely give Collingwood away. I kept my eyes humbly on my feet.
"Look at me," Miss Fawthorne commanded, and I slowly lifted my gaze to meet hers.
I was on the verge of tears. I could feel it. The next words out of her mouth shocked me to the core.
"Poor, dear, lonely, unhappy Flavia Deluce," she said, lifting my chin with a forefinger and gazing fondly into my eyes with a wry smile.
What was I to think?
She might as well have slapped my face. If she had, I'd have known how to handle it. But this unexpected compassion caught me completely off guard. Scuppered, I believe is a nautical word. I didn't know how to respond. As I was raising my eyes to hers, my supernaturally acute hearing, a trait I had inherited from Harriet, my mother, detected a scraping noise in the chimney. Even without looking round, I knew that soot was falling into the hearth. To a trained ear, the sound is unmistakable. Miss Fawthorne, praised be all the saints, had not noticed it. Her hearing apparatus was considerably older than mine, and blunted by time.
I was offering up a silent prayer of thanks for my deliverance when there was a sudden rush of sound and cold air. Something came rocketing down the chimney and exploded into the room with a sickening thump. The candle blew out, and we were plunged instantly into darkness. Miss Fawthorne, and I must give her credit for this, had the candle burning again in seconds. She must still have had the matchbook in her hands. Collingwood lay sprawled on the carpet, her face and hands as black as any Welsh coal miner's, her open red mouth and white eyes giving her the appearance of some fiend who had just been vomited up out of the pit. Beside her, what appeared at first to be a charred log was still rolling slowly toward us, unfurling as it came, like a roll of dropped lavatory paper, the sooty and discoloured Union Jack in which it was wrapped. I must state here that I have no fear whatsoever of being in a room in the dark with a corpse. In fact, quite the contrary. The little shiver I experience is one of excitement, not of fear. As the bundle rolled, the skull became detached and tumbled to a stop at my feet. At the core of the bundle was a blackened and desiccated human body, and I knew, even before it came to rest, that it had been dead for some time. Quite some time. Chapter 3. There we were, the four of us, me, Miss Fawthorne, Collingwood, and the corpse, all equally motionless. It was one of those moments our Victorian ancestors called a tableau, a frozen pose with none of us moving so much as a muscle, a moment when time stood still, a moment when eternity stopped to take a deep breath before rushing on and sweeping us with it into a future that could never be undone. Then Collingwood began to cry. A long, low, drawn-out sobbing that threatened to become a howl. Miss Fawthorne went white in the candlelight. Of the four of us, only the corpse and I were calm. I could hardly wait to have the electric lights switched on so that I could have a good gander. I have seen numerous dead bodies in my lifetime, each more interesting than the last, and each more instructive. This corpse, if I was counting correctly, was number 7. Even by the sparse light of the guttering candle, I had already decided, because of the slight frame and thin wrists, that this one was almost certainly female. The sooty skull and the horribly grinning jaws gave her the look of a freshly unwrapped mummy. Tarred by time and the chimney into a smoked kipper. Although that might not seem like an appropriate thought, I must be truthful. It was what I was thinking at the moment. First reactions are not always ones we can later be proud of. But I knew from personal experience that there would always be time, before I was questioned, to concoct a more charitable version to make myself look good. That's the way the human mind works. At least, mine does. Time had resumed, but still crawled, as it tends to do in such circumstances. Miss Fawthorne seemed to be moving across the room, as slowly as a stick insect on a twig in a nature film. After an eternity, she switched on the lights. "Collingwood," she demanded, in a voice that was far too quiet to be comforting. "What have you done?" While Collingwood, black as old frizzle, her arms wrapped round her knees, had begun rocking herself back and forth on the hardwood floor, giving out a wail which I believe is called keening, a hair-raising howl that arises from some ancient banshee part of our brain. It was hardly human. If this were the cinema, someone would slap her face and reduce her to civilized sobbing, but I hadn't the heart. I dropped to my knees and cradled her in my arms. "Fetch some water," I heard my mouth ordering Miss Fallthorn. And brandy, quickly, she's going into shock.
Miss Fallthorn began to say something, but thought better of it, and strode out of the room. I yanked a quilt from the bed and threw it round Collingwood's shoulders. I covered the cadaver and the skull with a sheet, but not before having a jolly good gander at the grisly remains. With Miss Fallthorn gone, here was a heaven-sent opportunity. I knew that I would have no second chance. The body was, as I have said, smoke-blackened. The flag in which it had been wrapped had acted as a container, in the same way, or so it is said, that banana leaves are used by natives of some of the far-flung outposts of the empire, such as India, to bake fish. The detached skull was as black as a bowling ball, bizarrely bare of hair and skin. The curled fingers of both hands were pulled up to where the chin should have been, as if death had caught its victim sleeping. Clutched loosely in one of them was what appeared to be a small tarnished medallion. I nestled it in my handkerchief and pocketed the thing immediately, before Miss Fallthorn could return. All hail to the gods who had sent me to bed fully clothed. The garments in which the body was clad were too tangled and smoky to identify. They might once have been a pauper's rags, or the robes of a fairy tale princess. Death by cooking is not beautiful. Or had she met her end by some other means, or perhaps in some other place? Like a police photographer, my mind began taking an efficient and methodical series of mental snapshots. Close-ups of the skull, the blackened teeth, the hands, the feet, which were bare except for a single scorched woolen sock, half off. I peeled it back an inch or two from the shrunken ebony ankle and saw by the inner surface that it had originally been red. This examination was not made any easier by the fact that Collingwood had now begun howling like an air raid siren, her voice rising and falling unnervingly. "It's all right," I kept telling her, all the while keeping my eyes on the dead body. "Everything is all right. Miss Fallthorn will be back in a jiffy." Did I imagine it, or did Collingwood now begin to ululate, as Daffy would put it, all the louder? Quite frankly, she was getting on my nerves. "Put a cork in it," I said. "You're drooling." As anyone with older sisters will tell you, there's no quicker way to make a female dry up, no matter her age, than to point out that she has slobber on her face. So I was not surprised then when Collingwood hiccuped to an abrupt halt. "What is that thing?" she asked, hauling herself on her bottom as quickly as she could across the floor and away from the sheet-draped body. "It's a bird. Rather a large one. A stork, I believe. Or perhaps an ibis." I'll admit, this was a bit of a stretch, even for me. It had been quite obvious that the blackened skull didn't have a long, curving beak. But then neither had the mummified birds I had seen in the Natural History Museum. Their beaks had been bandaged to their breasts, both for neatness and to make things easy for their long-dead embalmers. "How would a stork get trapped in the chimney?" "Happens all the time," I said, "during deliveries. They just don't report it because it's too depressing. Some sort of unwritten agreement with the newspapers." Collingwood's mouth fell open, but I will never know what she was about to say, since at that very instant Miss Fallthorn returned with a glass of water and a decanter of what I assumed was brandy. "Drink this," she ordered, and Collingwood obeyed at once, with remarkably little fuss, finishing off all of the former and a good slug of the latter. "I fear she's awakened the house," Miss Fallthorn said, glancing first at her wristwatch and then at me. "No matter, I suppose. The police shall have to be called anyway. Not that..." There was a knock at the door. "Who is it?"
Miss Fawthorne demanded.
Fitzgibbon, miss.
Miss Fawthorne sprang to the electrical switch like a sudden gazelle.
We mustn't set a bad example, she whispered. Lights out means what it says.
Again we were wrapped in darkness, but for no more than a few moments. Then a match flared, and Miss Fawthorne touched it to the candle's wick.
Come, she called out,
and the door opened. At first, I saw only the round reflections of Fitzgibbon's spectacles, floating as if weightless in the air. She took a single step forward into the room, then froze, and all at once, miraculously, she was surrounded by a sea of pale, disembodied female faces peering over her shoulder. Oddly enough, the thought that sprang to my mind at that instant was the famous passage in which St. Luke is describing the Nativity. As best I can recall, it goes something like this.
And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men.
Although the Bible, of course, at least in the King James Version, for some reason known only to its translators, and to the King himself, has no quotation marks. Even now, I can still see the white faces of those cherubim and seraphim suspended eerily in the shadows behind the frozen Fitzgibbon. The students of Miss Bodicote's Female Academy. My classmates. This was my first glimpse of them, and theirs of me.
Begone, girls, Miss Fawthorne commanded, clapping her hand several times, smartly,
and like puppets being jerked off stage in a rather sinister Punch and Judy, they vanished.
Take Collingwood to her bed, Miss Fawthorne instructed Fitzgibbon. She's had a bad shock.
Did she think I hadn't? Like a reluctant robot, Fitzgibbon hauled Collingwood to her feet and led her to the door, quilt and all.
It was quick of you to have thought of the sheet, Miss Fawthorne said when they were gone, shooting me a piercing look above the candle's flame. You have made an excellent start, Flavia. Except for allowing Collingwood in your room, she added. Both of you must be punished, of course.
I might have pointed out, I suppose, that Collingwood had come into the room uninvited, and that since I was asleep at the time, I could scarcely have prevented it, to say nothing of the fact that being newly arrived, I had not been informed of the stupid rule. But I kept my bun trap shut. It is decisions like this, for better or for worse, which make you who you are. Instead, I stooped to lift the corner of the sheet.
No, don't, please, Miss Fawthorne snapped, and I let it fall.
What harm could there possibly be in having another squint? But I knew in that moment that there would never be another chance. Generally, when you discover a body, you have the luxury of close examination before the police are called in to trample the scene like cows at a picnic. But not always, and this was going to be one of those times. I had seen all that I was going to see. Whatever the physical evidence, it was already in my head. Besides, I should have thought Miss Fawthorne might want to learn as much as she could about the cadaver that had, until recently, inhabited her chimney.
Or did she know already?
I stood primly by, allowing her to regain control. I suppose I shall have to report it, she said for the second time, almost as if thinking aloud, as if she were being forced into it. Perhaps she was thinking of the Academy's reputation. I could already see the headlines. Carcass cooked in chimney. Body at Miss Bodicote's. Girls' school aghast. If the newspapers here in Canada were anything like the ones back home, we could be in for a jolly couple of days. But you must be absolutely exhausted, she said. And until that moment, I hadn't thought about it. 6 days at sea, and another on the train, to say nothing of the fact that it was now the middle of the night.
Miss Fawthorne's words were hypnotic. I was suddenly yawning like the Cheddar Gorge, my eyes full of grit.
You can't sleep here, obviously, she said, waving a hand at the sheet-covered form on the floor. I shall put you up in my sitting room.
I had a fleeting vision of Miss Fawthorne nailing my severed head to the wall, as if I were a mounted trophy, some wild animal that she had shot in Africa or in the Arctic wastes.
Come along, then, she said, leading the way by candlelight.
The electric lamps remained switched off. At Miss Bodycote's, a rule, I could see, was a rule, was a rule.
Taffy would have been delighted with my insight. I would never have thought it possible, but I missed my sister. She had been the lemon on my fish, the vinegar on my chips, I realized with a sudden pang, and that without her, life from now on was going to be less tasty. It was an odd thought to have at that particular moment, but then life itself was odd. At least mine was.
Get a grip, Flavia, I remember thinking. Steady on.
We were now walking along a panelled corridor, Miss Fawthorne leading the way.
This is our old girl's gallery, she said, raising the candlestick so that I could better see the long rows of black-framed photographs that lined the gallery on either side. Tier upon tier they rose up round us, flickering in the candlelight, faces of every size and shape imaginable. And again I thought of the hordes of angels. Well, I had been told that Miss Bodycote's had strong ties with the church, hadn't I? Even so, it hadn't prepared me for the sight of all these scores of black-framed souls, each one staring directly down at me, and none of them laughing, as if they were some solemn heavenly jury, and I the prisoner at the bar.
And here, of course, Miss Fawthorne said, is your mother. She should have warned me. I was not prepared. Here was Harriet, in her black frame, gazing lovely out at me with such a look. In that young face, my face, was everything that needed to be said. And in her look, all the words that she had never had the chance to speak. Directly beneath Harriet's photograph was a small wall sconce, and in it was a spray of heartbreakingly fresh flowers. Suddenly, I was quaking. Miss Fawthorne put a hand gently on my shoulder.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't think. I ought to have prepared you.
We stood for a moment in silence, as if we were the only two left alive in that catacomb of the dead.
She is much honoured here, Miss Fawthorne said.
She is much honoured everywhere, I said,
perhaps a little too sharply. I realized, almost as I said it, that there was a certain resentment in my words. I had caught myself by surprise.
Are they all dead?
I asked, pointing to the portraits, partly to change the subject, and partly to show that there were no hard feelings.
Good Lord, no, Miss Fawthorne said. This one went on to become a swimming medalist. This one, Nancy Severance, a film star. Perhaps you've heard of her. This one, the wife of a prime minister. And this one, well, she became famous in her own way.
That's what I should like to do, I said, to become famous in my own way.
That was it in a nutshell, and I was pleased that I had finally realized it. I did not want to be Harriet. I wanted to be myself. Flavia Deluce, full stop.
And who is this?
I asked, pointing to a striking and rather enigmatic-looking girl who gazed out at us with hooded eyes.
"Mrs. Bannerman is still with us at Miss Bodycote's," she said. "You shall meet her tomorrow. She is our chemistry mistress."
"Mildred Bannerman! Of course! She had been charged and acquitted, a number of years ago, after a sensational trial, of the murder of what the News of the World had called her wayward husband. It was claimed by the prosecution that she had poisoned the blade of the carving knife with which he cut up the Christmas turkey. It was an old trick, but a good one. Perisatis, the wife of Darius II of Persia, in the 3rd century BC, had murdered her daughter-in-law, Statira, in precisely the same way. By applying the poison to only the outer side of the blade, and serving Statira the first slice, she was able to dispatch her victim and yet eat from the bird herself, with little or no risk. It was called having your turkey and eating it too. By great good fortune and an even greater defense attorney, Mildred Bannerman had been spared the hangman's noose, and indeed had been portrayed to the jury as the real victim of the crime. And just think, in no more than a few hours, I would be meeting her.
We moved on through an endless maze of darkened corridors until, after what seemed like an eternity, Miss Fawthorne produced a set of keys. "These are my rooms," she said, flicking on the lights. Presumably, the rules didn't apply to her. "You may sleep on that couch," she said, pointing to a black leather monstrosity with a pattern of stitched dimples. "I shall bring you a blanket and a pillow." And with that, she was gone, leaving me standing in the middle of her sitting room, a room that reeked of cold, silent unhappiness. Was I picking up vibrations from the old girls who had been punished here for switching on a light after curfew? Or worse? I remembered the words that Daffy had read aloud from Nicholas Nickleby, the words of the schoolmaster, Wackford Squeers. "Let any boy speak a word without leave, and I'll take the skin off his back." But no, girls were not caned, Daffy had told me. They were reserved for the more exquisite tortures. Miss Fawthorne was back with a pillow and a tartan motoring blanket. "Sleep now," she said. "I shall try not to disturb you when I return." She switched off the light, and the door closed with a chilling click. I listened for a key in the lock, but even with my acute hearing, there was nothing more than the sound of her retreating footsteps. She was going to her study to call the police. That much seemed certain. I was straining my brain to think of ways I might contrive to be present in Edith Cavell at the moment the sheet was removed and the body revealed. Perhaps I could wander in, rubbing my eyes and claiming a history of sleepwalking, or that I was in desperate need, due to some hereditary tropical disorder, of a glass of cold water. But before I could put either of these plans into action, I fell asleep. I dreamed, of course, of Buckshaw. I was riding my bicycle, Gladys, up the long avenue of chestnuts. Even in the dream, I was thinking how remarkable it was that I could hear a skylark singing and smell the trampled chamomile of the defunct south lawn. That and the decay of the old house itself. Dogger was waiting at the front door.
"Welcome home, Miss Flavia," he said. "We have missed you."
I rode past him, into the foyer and up the east staircase, which goes to show how ridiculous dreams can be. Although I had ridden down the stairs, I had never, ever been guilty of riding up them. In my chemical laboratory, an experiment was in busy progress. Beakers bubbled, flasks simmered, and various coloured liquids flowed importantly to and fro in twists and coils of glass tubing.
Although I couldn't remember the purpose of the experiment, I was full of excitement at the outcome. I would write it up in my laboratory notebook. From hypothesis to conclusion, all neatly presented so that even an idiot could follow each step of my brilliant thinking. The chemical journals would come to fisticuffs over the rights to publish my work.
And yet, there was an indescribable sadness about this dream. The kind of sadness that comes when the heart and the brain do not agree. Half of me was filled with joy. Half of me wanted to weep. When I awoke, a bell was ringing somewhere.
Chapter 4. My eyes refused to open. It was as if, as I slept, someone had glued them shut.
"Hurry up," Miss Fawthorne's voice was saying. "The bell has already gone."
I looked up at her from bleary sockets.
"Your uniform is on the chair," she said. "Put it on and come down for breakfast. There's a ewer on the table. Wash your face, brush your teeth. Try to look presentable."
And then she was gone. How could anyone be so changeable? I wondered. The woman's moods appeared to be connected to some inner weathercock that swung wildly round with every wind. One moment she was almost tender, and the next a harridan. Even the mercurial Daffy, from whom I had learned both words, was no match for these cyclonic changes of character. The cold horsehair stuffing gave out a groan as I sat up and levered myself to my feet. My back was sore, my knees were numb, and I had a crick in my neck. I already had the feeling that this was not going to be a red-letter day. I forced myself to crawl into the school uniform Miss Fawthorne had laid out for me, a sort of navy blue wool pinafore dress with a pleated skirt, black tights, white blouse, and necktie, the latter striped diagonally in the school colours, yellow and black. A navy blazer completed the horror. I winced as I examined my reflection in a silver tea service that stood on a side table. Hideous. I looked like someone in one of those baggy bathing costumes that you see on Victorian postcards. I pinched a sugar cube and washed it down with a swig of slightly soured milk from the creamer. Curse this life, I thought. And then I remembered the dead body upstairs, and I cheered up at once. Had the police come in the night? Surely they must have by now. I was hardly in a position to ask, but there is no law against keeping your eyes peeled and your ears open, is there? I had been worried that I would be stared at, but no one gave me so much as a second glance as I came tentatively down the staircase and paused on the landing. From some far corner of the house came the sound of a distant regiment of girls, all talking and laughing at the same time. I won't say that my blood ran cold, but it distinctly cooled. I was not at my best with hordes, a fact that I had not entirely realized until the day I was sacked, unfairly, from the girl guides. My case had been debated from the vicarage kitchen all the way up to the solemnly panelled council chamber of the Girl Guide Imperial Headquarters in London. But it was no use. The die, as someone or another had said, was cast. I recalled with bitterness the moment that Miss Delaney ripped my badges from my sleeves as the troop was made to chant in unison, "Shame, shame, 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 shame." I knew suddenly how the children of Israel must have felt when they were cast out by the Lord. Farewell to the Scarlet Pimpernel Patrol. And farewell to their motto, "Do good by stealth." I had done my best to fulfill that commandment, but it was hardly my fault that things had gone so badly wrong. Fate loves slight miscalculations, the vicar had told me later, and it was true.
I would not likely ever live it down.
Better hustle your bustle, someone said, touching my arm. A short, stocky girl with black-framed spectacles. I almost jumped out of my skin. My nerves were edgy.
Sorry, she said. Didn't mean to startle you, but at Bod's, punctuality is paramount. Translated into English, that means if you're late for breakfast, they'll nail your hide to the barn door.
I nodded acknowledgement and followed her down the stairs. At the bottom, I stuck out a hand.
Deluce, FS, I said, sticking to the formula Collingwood had used.
I know, the girl said. You're quite notorious.
I followed her into the great hall, a vast, rafted expanse of dark-hanging timber, a medieval cowshed with trestle tables. The hubbub was deafening. A couple of harried-looking servers in white were ladling great gouts of porridge into bowls. I took a seat at the end of one of the long tables and tucked in. As I ate, I looked discreetly round the room, pretending not to. As a new girl, it would be impolite to stare. Not that I really cared. It was important, though, not to draw attention to myself. There was a possibility that whoever had killed the cadaver in the chimney was in this very room at this very moment. I would need to begin my investigations from scratch. I looked round the hall for Collingwood, but she was nowhere in sight. Perhaps she had been excused to recover from last night's ordeal. Because most of the girls had their heads in the feed troughs, it was not easy to examine their faces. I noticed, though, that even as they ate, they were still talking rapidly to one another from the corners of their mouths, which made it difficult to read their lips, as I had trained myself to do. Besides, I didn't want to stare. It wasn't too much of a chore to guess the sensational topic. The buzz and thrill of bad news was heavy in the air. An older girl, two tables away, elbowed her neighbour in the ribs and pointed at me with her chin. When they saw that I had noticed, they both looked away quickly. The faculty, all of them women, sat on a raised dais at one end of the hall, overlooking the grazing girls. At the centre of the high table sat Miss Fawthorne, her head inclined, talking with pinched brows to a youngish-looking woman whose short black hair was as tight as a bathing cap. There are rare and precious moments, when one is a stranger in a room, that one can examine its inhabitants with little or no prejudice. Without knowing so much as their names, it is possible to form an assessment based purely upon observation and instinct. Even at a glance, I could tell that the faculty of Miss Bodycote's female academy had one thing in common. They were all dead serious. There was no frivolity, no laughter, and no lipstick. Even as they ate, they spoke quietly to one another, as if they were a panel of grave judges, with all the weight of justice on their shoulders. Could one of them be a murderess? As a simple exercise, I set myself to deduce their teaching specialties. The woman at the far right, with short, steel-grey hair, was almost certainly the French mistress. She had that Cupid's bow mouth with the raised corner and peculiar but slight twist of the outer nostril that can come only from speaking French from the cradle. No Englishwoman could ever possibly form those shapes with her mouth while talking. I knew that from my own close observation of Mrs. Lennox, Chantelle Lennox, who lived next door to the vicarage in Bishop's Lacey, and who had been brought back to England as a sort of war trophy by her husband, Norman. She was from Montmartre, pronounced through the nose. Next at the table was a hatchet-faced individual with high cheekbones and an air of solitude about her, who seemed to exist in her own aura, almost as if she was surrounded by an invisible bell jar. Sad, I thought. Lonely and unpopular. My first thought was that, judging by her face alone, this should be Mildred Bannerman, the acquitted merticide. a useful word meaning husband killer that Daffy had taught me. A word unknown, it would appear, not only to the shrillest of the tabloid newspapers, but even to the Times. But no, just yesterday I had seen a schoolgirl photo of Miss Bannerman in the old girls' gallery. She could not possibly have aged into such a hard-looking creature. My eyes moved on along the table, and there, on Miss Fawthorne's right, sat a sweet-faced pixie, the youngest teacher of the lot. Was this the girl from the photograph? She appeared still not much more than my sister Feely's age, which was 18. She must be older than she looks, I thought. Not wanting to stare, I watched her from the corner of my eye, reveling in the very thought of breakfasting with a killer, Mildred Bannerman, at last. The others were unremarkable, a mere assortment of noses and chins, eyes and ears, plucked from a sack and tossed together at random.
"Welcome to Bard's," said a voice at my ear.
It was the girl whose hand I had shaken on the stair.
"Van Ark," she said. "We've already met. I've been more or less put in charge of you until you're on the rolls. I'm a monitress, by the way."
She looked slowly round the room as if she were keeping an eye out for predators. Satisfied for the moment that we were safe, she turned her attention back to me.
"Say, you don't have a cigarette on you by any chance?"
"No," I said. "I don't smoke."
"Are you allowed to? In here?"
Van Ark made a honking noise through her nose.
"Of course not. We use the third floor Kaibo."
"I beg your pardon?"
"The Kaibo, the Bog House, the Four Flusher, the Holy Tabernacle."
"The Crapper, you mean," I said.
"The Crapper? Ha, that's a good one," she hooted,
choking on her porridge. She was seized with a spasm of coughing, and her face grew red. Her hands flew to her throat. Her breathing had become a loud, wheezing gurgle. I knew instantly that some mass of the glutinous stuff had lodged in Van Ark's windpipe, and that she was in real danger. Her face was already darkening. I leapt to my feet and began pounding her furiously on the back, with the flat of my hand at first, and then with both fists. I couldn't help noticing that everyone round us, even the faculty, seemed stuck to their chairs. No one, besides me, had moved a muscle. The room had gone silent. Suddenly, and unexpectedly, Van Ark coughed up a disgusting clot of porridge and spat it noisily out onto the floor. "Are you all right?" I asked. She was now sucking in great, grateful breaths of fresh air, her shoulders heaving. Her colour was improving by the second. She grimaced.
"No," she croaked. "But I must go on. It's trad. Monitresses are not allowed to be ill."
I looked at her in disbelief. Was she joking?
"If we catch so much as a sniffle, they put us to death."
She could see I didn't believe her.
"It's true," she whispered. "They have an abattoir. There's a secret door behind a cupboard in the infirmary." "With bloody meat hooks hanging from the ceiling," I said, catching on.
Practical jokers can recognize one another as easily as bees from the same hive. Van Ark and I had far more in common than I had realized.
"Exactly," she said. "Meat hooks and racks of butcher's knives, and they feed the mulch to the chickens." "Or what's left of it, after making the porridge," I said, shoving a large spoonful of the stuff into my mouth and chewing it with relish.
Van Ark sucked in a breath, and her eyes went as big as saucers.
"Ooh," she said, "how disgusting."
And I knew that I had made an impression. Van Ark picked up a table napkin and gave my mouth a couple of dabs, as if I were dribbling porridge.
"Shh,"
she said, covering her own mouth as she faked a small additional cough.
"Druce is watching us. She reads lips."
Much as I wanted to brag about my own achievements in that department, I made a quick decision to keep a few tricks up my sleeve. It is sometimes better to let science be thought magic. Two tables away, the large girl who had elbowed her neighbour in the ribs, this must be Druce, was staring openly. She was the only person in the hall looking at us. Everyone else was studiously looking away, as Anglicans invariably do when faced with group embarrassment. It was a trait I had noticed even as a child, which, as nearly as I could puzzle out, was somehow connected with the famous ostrich and sand reaction. Roman Catholics, by contrast, would have been clambering over one another for a front row seat.
"Let's get out of here," Fanarc said. "I need some fresh air. Come on, we've got a few minutes before the next bell."
As we pushed back our chairs, I turned deliberately toward Druce, and as if I were talking to Van Ark, clearly pronounced the word flapdragon. It was my favourite word from Shakespeare. Not as long as the honorifica bilitudinitatibus, which preceded it in Love's Labour's Lost, but enough of a workout to let Druce know that when it came to lip-reading, she was not dealing with someone who was wet behind the ears.
"You sure you haven't got a cigarette?"
We were leaning against the stone rim of a neglected goldfish pool in a small courtyard behind the laundry.
"No," I said. "I told you, I don't smoke. It's a filthy habit." "Says who?" Van Ark demanded, squinting like Popeye and taking up a boxer's stance, squeezing her biceps to make them bulge.
I knew she was joking.
"Never mind," she said. "Here comes Fabian. She's always good for a fag. Fabian, over here."
Fabian was a tall blonde who looked as if she came from Finland, a pale, cool Nordic type who wore rather too much face powder, as if she had a lot of spots to hide. I wondered if she, like me, was exiled from her homeland.
"How much?" Fabian asked, holding out a single cigarette.
She didn't even need to be asked.
"A nickel for two," Van Ark said.
"Three for a dime," Fabian counted,
and the deal was done.
"It's highway robbery, that's what it is," Van Ark said, lighting up when Fabian was gone. "She's only been here a year, and she's already as rich as Croesus. She pays 17 cents for a pack and makes 300% profit. It isn't fair."
Nickels? Dimes? I knew that cents were roughly equivalent to pence, but beyond that, Canadian currency was a veiled mystery. Why had I ever been sent away from the land of the sixpence? The land of half-crowns, halfpennies, florins, farthings, and shillings? The land of decent coinage, where everything made sense? How could I possibly learn to survive in such a pagan place, where trams were streetcars, vans and lorries were trucks, pavements were sidewalks, jumpers were sweaters, petrol was gasoline, aluminium was aluminum, sweets were candy, a full stop was a period, and cheerio was goodbye? A towering wave of homesickness broke over me, a wave even greater than the Atlantic gales through which I had safely sailed. Greater than anything I could ever have possibly imagined. I put a hand against the stone wall to steady myself.
"Are you all right?" Van Ark asked anxiously.
"Yes," I said weakly, and then again, more strongly, "yes." It was only the thought of this curious creature who stood so casually beside me, smoking, that gave me strength. If Van Ark could go from choking to joking and smoking in the wink of an eye, then surely so could I.
"Morning, ladies," said a voice behind me, making me jump. I whirled round to find what I took at first to be a weasel in a shabby trench coat. A thin young man with an alarmingly pale, pinched face and an unconvincing moustache.
students, I take it? He asked. A couple of Miss Bodycote's beauties.
Go away,
Van Ark said, pulling a nickel-plated whistle from her pocket.
Before I call the police.
Hey, take it easy. Don't do that, he said, dredging a damp leather wallet from the depths of the wreckage that was his raincoat. He flipped it open and held out what appeared to be some kind of official identity card.
Wallace Scroop, he said, offering it. The Morning Star. Mind if I ask you a few questions?
We're not allowed to speak to reporters,
Van Ark said.
Listen, he went on, ignoring her. I've heard this place is haunted. It's an old convent, you know. Ghostly footsteps in the night, all that sort of thing. I thought it would make an interesting story. You might even get your pictures in the paper.
There are no such things as ghosts. Or haven't you heard, Mr. Scroop? Any footsteps in the night at Miss Bodycote's are caused by too much lemonade at the school carnival, not by phantoms. Now please go away.
If I did, Scroop said, my editor would wring me out like a dishcloth. Come on, girls, have a heart. Let's be honest. What do you know about the body that was carted off to the morgue last night? Someone you know, maybe? Listen, I could make it worth your while.
I glanced at Van Ark, but she didn't seem surprised at the news. Without further warning, she jammed the whistle between her lips and blew a long, ear-piercing blast. For a fraction of a second, Wallace Scroop looked as stunned as if she had slapped his face. And then, with a couple of surprisingly coarse words, he was gone.
Creep!
Van Ark shot after him, but he was already too far away to have heard her. Somewhere indoors, a bell began to ring.
Curses! Van Ark muttered. Wouldn't you just know it?
She tossed the cigarette down and ground it out beneath her heel.
Come on, she said. We've got to go. They've put you in the fourth form, at least for the time being. As I said, Miss Falthorne told me to oversee you until she gets round to the formalities. She's got rather a lot on her plate at the moment, or so she says.
I should say she has, I volunteered, wondering if Van Ark's had been one of the cherub faces floating in the darkness.
Did you see what happened in Edith Cavell last night?
I hated myself as soon as I had said it. I am not ordinarily a gossip, but some inside force was suddenly making me spit out information like a clockwork ticket dispenser. Was I automatically sucking up to Van Ark because of my inferior position as a new girl? I surely hoped not.
No, she said, but I heard about it, that's for darn sure.
I said nothing. I have learned to use silence as a jimmy to pry information free. Or did I keep my mouth buttoned because I was still nauseated from that tidal wave of homesickness? I shall never know. But whatever the reason, I held my tongue. And it paid off. Van Ark couldn't resist demonstrating her superior knowledge.
The guff has it that Miss Falthorne found you standing over a dead body in Edith Cavell, and Collingwood in hysterics. I told you, you're notorious. Now hurry up before they skin us and use our guts for snowshoes.
Chapter 5. As we made our way along the dark passage that led from the back entrance to the great hall, the bell clanged again.
Oh, corn, Van Ark whispered in the sudden silence that followed. Now we're in for it. We'll be blacked.
Blacked? I said. Collingwood had used this term, but I still had no idea what being blacked involved. Although I must say, it didn't sound like much fun. I had visions of being painted with boot polish, like the vicar as Othello in the parish play. It seemed rather an extreme punishment for missing a stupid bell. As if by chance, another bell sounded, this one closer and less loud.
It's the doorbell, Van Ark said.
As sometimes happens when you're in a pinch, fate offered up a free spin of the wheel, and I took it.
Rather than following Van Ark, I veered across the hall and opened the door. There, with his finger still on the electric bell button, stood a tall and excessively slender man. He had the long face and long fingers of a carved medieval saint and the body of a long-distance runner. A younger, shorter man in a dark blue uniform stood sturdily to one side, his feet apart and his hands clasped, I assumed, behind his back. He might as well have had assistant stamped across his forehead with indelible ink.
"Yes?"
I asked, taking the upper hand. Behind me, Van Ark sucked in a noisy breath at my boldness.
"Miss Falthorn," said the medieval saint.
I could tell already that he was a man of few words, rather like Gary Cooper.
"Ah,"
I said, "you must be the police." It was, of course, a dim-witted thing to say, and yet at the same time, precisely right. The tall man nodded, almost reluctantly.
"That's correct," he said.
He was giving nothing away.
"I'm Flavia Deluce," I said, sticking out my hand. "And you are?"
"Inspector Gravenhurst."
"Ah," I said, as if I had been already half expecting that to be his name. He gave me a quick but firm handshake. I could see that he was sizing me up, even as our hands went up and down.
"And Sergeant," I said, taking a chance.
Surely an inspector's right-hand man would be a sergeant of one kind or another.
"LaBelle,"
the sergeant said, not correcting me.
"I shall tell Miss Falthorn you wish to see her," I said.
The inspector nodded, stepping inside and looking round the great hall with keen interest, taking in every detail with his penetrating gaze. I liked this man already.
"By the way," I said, turning back toward him, "I'm the one who discovered the body."
This was not precisely true, but it was my only chance of becoming involved in the case. I resisted the powerful urge to tell him that this corpse was not my first, that in fact cadavers were my calling card. Modesty, though, prevailed. The inspector brightened immediately.
"Indeed," he said,
and I liked him even more. Pity, though, that he wasn't a member of the legendary Royal Canadian Mounted Police. That would have made things perfect. But it wasn't likely his fault. His height had probably exceeded some idiotic and arbitrary physical requirement.
"Van Ark," I said, surprised by my own boldness. "Run upstairs and tell Miss Falthorn the inspector's here."
I resisted, adding, "There's a good ducks." Van Ark's mouth fell open. "Van Ark's a monitress," I explained to the inspector. "She has first dibs on fetching the head." It was the right thing to say. Van Ark squeezed off a proud smile and was off up the stairs like a galloping rocket.
"You're English," Inspector Gravenhurst said.
"Yes," I replied. My accent alone made me stand out among these Canadian girls like a...
"Been over long?"
the inspector asked.
"Since last night," I said. "Well, yesterday, actually." How I loved talking to this man. What a breath of fresh air it was to converse with someone who didn't natter endlessly on and on like a village spinster. I wanted desperately to tell him about Inspector Hewitt, my great friend back home in Bishop's Lacey. But there would be time enough for that later. I would find a plausible way of dragging my dear inspector and his goddess wife, Antigone, into the conversation at a more appropriate time. There was a clatter behind me on the stairs as Van Ark came scuttering quickly down